Senior X wins Commander Q.
36 Juífe Commander Q.
36 X with Commander Q. 3.
And spirit and all right,
both ways. Empathy is not gay. Empathy is not black. Empathy is bisexual. Empathy must go both ways. It's not gay. Empathy is not black. Empathy is bisexual. It must go both ways. It's not gay. Empathy is not black. Empathy is bisexual. It must go both ways.
It's not gay. Empathy is not black. Empathy is bisexual. Empathy, it must go both ways. It's not gay. Empathy is not black. Empathy is bisexual.
Empathy is bisexual.
ask from empathy is bisexual. Empathy, it must go through, is not gay, is not gay.
He is bisexual.
It must come over.
Saturday, October 15th, 1999, 8:14 a.m. Newman Road, bed, mauled and mess. Well, since the last entry, several days ago, I've kept working on my thesis day after day. And I can report now that it's, I don't know, maybe 50 pages long, 5-0. I've accounted for 1995, 1996, and 1997 in the history of Scriptor Press. Two more years to go. 98 is going to be somewhat more complicated, but 99 will be the real complication one. However, today I'm taking a break from that. I wanted to get up early, get off to a good start, primarily because my evening is completely obligated, I mean happily so, but nonetheless so, in terms of getting any writing done. It's not going to happen tonight after a certain point. That certain point probably being when I meet Rick at North State. At 6:15 or thereabouts, to take the train up to Beverly to meet Mio, to go to a place where this woman is going to perform. She's going to perform musically the poetry of Rumi. Oh man, this is something that the three of us have been talking about for, it seems like, months. I mean, Rick was still in Seattle when we were talking about this. I sent him the poster that Mio mailed me, so, you know, it's been going on a while. Probably since, after Burning Man, but I'm not really sure. Quite a while. And Rick and Mio will get to meet, which is really great, and, I'm sure after we see this event, the night will carry on. Yeah, that's how things stand. I mean, that's what's gonna happen tonight. So, today I want to, make something of, the time I've got. I've got this period now, between now, it's 8:15 and 11 this morning when I go on the air. And then there's 11 to 2 when I'm on the air, which, during which I can only accomplish so much other than just being on the air. And then I think I'm going to see a movie to kind of squish them up. But of course, it has to be a movie that ends in time for me to be able to get the subway to North Station. Excuse me, to meet Rick, to get the, you know, train to Beverly. So it's a 6:30 train and he wanted us to meet at 6:15. So I'm gonna try and make that happen on my end. Tired, but I'm awake, and I want to be awake right now. I want to be awake and aware and into it. I'm going to play Fish's Blonde Boy, 89, on my show. It's a 47-minute album. I'm going to read, finally, after doing it now for 3 weeks, I'm going to finish reading Timothy Leary's introduction to LSD book. Read some poetry, possibly some fiction. The one I don't not quite know about is like news. So I like to read news. I don't know, news that's relevant to the rest of the show. I don't so much pin down what it has to be as I like it to be something that's relevant. I have schedules for on Miracle Sammy and the Miracle Orchestra, and Phish tickets go on sale soon. So to CSNY tickets, I found out, from March, late March, no less. They go on sale Monday for late March. It's kind of ridiculous, but it's true. I guess I wish there was time for something more, something else. And sometimes I don't get to the news because I don't have anything compelling to read. I just sort of find something and I read it, but it's not anything that has to be read or I really want to read, so I don't really make time for it. But that also has to do with, you know, like last week, it had to do with the fact that the Phish record I played, Yinta, was well over an hour long, so the one this week is a lot shorter, and the ones subsequent, the next few weeks, are going to be, like, they're not going to be short as today's, which is only 47 minutes, but they'll be about 60 minutes, I think, so they simply won't be as long as the one last week. But it is the weak link in my show. It's the one thing I don't reliably do every week. And it's the one thing that's not reliably interesting every week. You know, or when it does come on. I guess news for the longest time was Burning Man. I guess that's really where it was at. That was easy. Well, regarding the show, the last couple weeks, I mean, more or less since I've been back doing it regularly, which was, this is the third week in a row that I've done it, you know, consecutively, well, Alan's been around and his scruffy friend Mike, who wants to make the station, quote, go legit, end quote, and he says we'll have to cool it for a while briefly before we can go back to doing our thing. I don't know, these kind of things sort of, they irritate me. They really do irritate me. I don't want to deal in any of that. I mean, I have a key to the gallery, so they really don't need to be around, and I prefer that they weren't around, actually. And the truth of it is, they don't bother me a lot, but they're around enough with their sort of restlessness and plans that it's aggravating. I want to go, I want to do my show, I don't want to be bothered by anybody. I really don't. I don't want to be have to talking to anybody. Because shortly into the show, I take my mushrooms and I start tripping and, you know, it's like, well, there I am, off to the races, and and that being true, you know, I just don't really want to talk to a lot of people. I want to do my thing. And I want to do it well. I really want to do it well. So, I I mean, it's an important project. In its own way, I certainly planned for it. I mean, I spent $15 on a fish disc this week, and I've been spending money on music regularly for months now to have a new record to play every week. So, you know, if nothing else, I plan out the show to accommodate that. I did it on the road. I mean, it's something I take seriously. This is my 31st show. Next week will be 32, and then 33 will be the 30th. I started on the 30th of January, so that'll be 9 months, 33 shows. That's pretty good. It's pretty good. It's not, I mean, I've missed quite a few along the way, but, you know, it's okay. I actually haven't missed all that many. Because it's probably, like, you know, probably like 33 out of 40 or 33 out of 41. I mean, I've hit most of the shows. That's just the way it's been. I can't believe I've done this for so long. And the future of it is so tenuous. I mean, unlike my other projects, like, you know, the Electro Lounge, for example, I can't even foresee it not being there. I mean, I don't even go near it. Hell, before this week, I hadn't touched it since June. We didn't go anywhere. It was still there when I went to it to add to it this week. But this thing is so dependent on other people. Well, I guess it's dependent on Al, the owner of the gallery. The landlord raised his rent, but Al dealt with it in part by raising the DJ fees. Then there's this other guy, Mike, who wants to do all this shit, and I just think it's foolish. I think it's foolish to, quote, go legit, end quote. It just, what the fuck's the point? I mean, I don't know. It just, it, to me, it's a dubious prospect. Actually, I wouldn't care. But when he said go legit, then we have to cool it for a while. And it's like, what the hell does that mean? And I haven't been letting myself trouble too much about it, but I trouble just a little tiny bit about it. Maybe because, I mean, the topic matter of my show is I guess by some way considered kind of radical, and so, you know, I wonder if any restraints would be placed on me, and of course I'm not going to deal with it well. I don't know how I'd handle it. I don't know if the thing is really worth handling at all. On the other hand, the thing I find kind of reassuring is that I've been around the zeitgeist long enough to see how things go there, and things are just too strange and circuitous and kind of swirly for anybody to figure out what the hell's going to happen next most of the time. Unless real events impose themselves, like complaining neighbors or raised rent. what happens internally there, just, it's impossible to figure out, really. So, that, I've been allowing that to reassure me. I don't think it's an illegitimate thing to do. All right, enough of this.
Daniel X with Commander Q.
36 Jesuíf Commander Q.
36 X with Commander Q. Train.
And Spirit and Radio. The world.
Track of the album Before Last, and it's called A Saucer Full of Secrets, and it's it's the last thing we're going to play, and thanks very much for coming and listening.
Thank you.
It's really been nice playing here, you know.
They're probably in your coat.
Do it and they do it well. It's just it's not like
that. They get their poems published and blah blah blah.
Yeah.
But yeah, but like the raw viscera shit, like there's nobody can tell you how to do it.
No, it's life. It's life.
Yeah.
It's life.
Yeah.
It's your recounting of life.
You have to like, you know.
36X with Commander Q.
36X with Commander Q.
36X with Commander Q. Train.
And spirit and all revenue, all broadcast, broadcast the world.
36X with Commander Q.
Commander Q.
Before I go, I want to share this story with you because it's important to this point. I want your community to know that one of the coolest people I ever met was a transgender woman. And this is not a man that I knew that became a woman. This woman was trans when I met her. Lived in San Francisco. Daphne Dwoman is her name. I would do 18 shows in the Bay Area, sometimes in Oakland and Dirty Hood nightclub, and she would be there, a white trans woman, laughing loud and hard at everything I said, especially the trans jokes. Very puzzling. Because she was obviously trans. And one night after one of the shows, I met her. And what it was, turns out, it was her dream to be a comedian. And I was her hero. It's very moving. I could not dislike somebody that felt that way about me. We became fast friends. And when I made that special Sticks and Stones, right as it was coming out, I happened to be in San Francisco and I wanted to do a show, but I needed an opening act. And I remembered that trans woman I'd met. So I called her on the phone. And I called her myself. I said, "Hey, Daphne, this is Dave Chappelle." She couldn't believe it. And I go, "I'm in San Francisco." And then she starts saying a bunch of wild stuff. I was like, "Relax, man. I don't want any pussy." I was, I was calling because I'm doing a show and I need an opening act. And I was wondering if you'd open the show. And she was like, "Fuck yeah." Now, I didn't know this at the time, but this woman had only done stand-up comedy 8 times in her life. This is little to no experience. And now she's about to open a show for what many call the GOAT. She's an amateur in stature, but in practice, she was very professional. She showed up early, which is something I appreciate because I like people to be on time. She was dressed to the motherfucking nines. I mean, I'm transphobic, and even I was like, "You look nice." Went up on the stage with all the swag of a professional comedian, grabbed that mic and walked right down the middle and looked at the crowd like a gangster. Man, you should have seen her work. This bitch bombed for 45 minutes straight. And I am not exaggerating, young man, that show was terrible. Stunk. And then she brings me on, and you know, I was like a glass of water after a handful of salt. The crowd was happy to see me. I was killing it. But here's what impressed me. Any other comedian I've ever seen, if they had bombed as bad as she did, would have snuck out of the back of the theater and went home and cried or something. And she didn't do that. Not only did she not leave, she found a seat right up in front. You know, when a new comedian watches an experienced comedian in comedy, we call this taking class. And this bitch took my whole class. She sat up there and was laughing as hard as she always laughs, as if nothing bad had even happened to her. And I saw her show. Something bad happened to her. She was drunk. So she starts talking to me while I'm on stage. But the way a person would talk to a television when they were alone, she's talking to me like that. That didn't bother me because I knew her. But the crowd didn't like that shit at all because she sucked. And a guy in the back of the room stood up. And Daphne's hair was dyed blonde at the time. And the guy screamed out. And his energy felt wild as fuck. He said, "Hey, Daphne!" And everybody kind of clamped, like, got tense. We didn't know if it was a heckler or an active shooter. And he said, "Does the carpet match the drapes?" Yeah, it was fucked up. The whole crowd kind of groaned because it was so, like, mean. Everybody groaned except for Daphne. She kind of laughed, which was weird. And she didn't even look all the way back. She said, "Sir, I don't have carpets. I have hardwood floors." Just like that. Just like that. And boy, when she said that shit, it blew the roof off the place. Cut through all the tension with that one joke. She made up for 45 minutes of a stinker of a show. And after that, she could do no wrong. And I kept on rocking. She kept on talking to me. And then the show became something cooler than a show. It became like a conversation between a black man and a white trans woman, and we started getting to the bottom of shit. All them questions that you think about that you'd be afraid to ask, I was just asking them, and she was answering them, and her answers were funny as shit. The crowd was falling out of their chairs. And at the end of the show, I go, "Oh, Daphne," I said, "well, that was fun." I go, "I love you to death, but I have no fucking idea what you're talking about." The whole crowd laughed, except for Daphne. Now she looks at me like I'm not her friend anymore. Like I'm something bigger than me, like I'm the whole world and the guy. And she said, "I don't need you to understand me." I said, "What?" She said, "I just need you to believe," just like this, she goes, "that I'm having a human experience." And when she said it, the whole crowd kind of gasped. And I gave it a Fight Club look. I said, "I believe you, bitch." Because she didn't say anything about pronouns. She didn't say anything about me being in trouble. She said, "Just believe I'm a person and I'm going through it." And oh, I believe you because it takes one to know one. Then I told the crowd goodnight, and they start going crazy. And before the applause gets to its crescendo, I say, "And don't forget my opening act, Daphne." And the crowd stood up, and I looked at her, and tears came out of her eyes. She couldn't believe it was happening. I couldn't believe it was happening because her show stunk. And it was a great night. I remember the late, great Paul Mooney was there. A bunch of fly-ass comedy niggas was there. And we all went backstage and was just drinking and talking shit and laughing, and Daphne stole the room. She had everyone cracking up, spinning the yarn, telling us all these crazy stories about shit she be into. We all laughing real hard, and as she's telling us and everyone's laughing, I'm looking around, I'm like, "Oh my God, she is funny." I pulled her aside and I said, "You're hilarious. I didn't know that when you were on stage." I said, "You're doing some things wrong, but I can help you." I said, "Anytime I'm in San Francisco, why don't you open a show for me, and I'll just try to give you some pointers, see if you can't work this thing out." And she said, "Are you serious?" I was like, "Yeah." And she grabbed me real tight, hugged me, squeezed me, and I pushed her off violently because I'm transphobic. I said, "Boundaries, bitch!" When Sticks and Stones came out, a lot of people in the trans community were furious with me, and apparently they dragged me on Twitter. I don't give a fuck, because Twitter's not a real place. And the hardest thing for a person to do is go against their tribe if they disagree with their tribe, but Daphne did that for me. She wrote a tweet that was very beautiful, and what she said was, and it was almost exactly what she said. She said, "Punching down on someone requires you to think less of them. And I know him, and he doesn't. He doesn't punch up, he doesn't punch down, He punches lines, and he's a master at his craft. That's what she said. Beautiful tweet. Beautiful friend. It took a lot of heart to defend me like that. And when she did that, the trans community dragged that bitch all over Twitter. For days, they was going in on her, and she was holding her own because she's funny. But 6 days after that wonderful night I described to you, my friend Daphne killed herself. Oh, yeah. It's a true story. My heart was broken. Yeah, it wasn't the jokes. I don't know if it was them dragging her. I don't know what's going on in her life, but I bet dragging her didn't help. I was very angry at them. I was very angry at her. I felt like Daphne lied to me. She always says she identified as a woman. And then one day she goes up to the roof of a building and jumps off and kills herself. Clearly, only a man would do some gangster shit like that. Hear me out. As hard as it is to hear a joke like that, I'm telling you right now, Daphne would have loved that joke. That's why she was my friend. I was reading her obituary, and I found out she was survived by a daughter. And the moment I found that out, and this is true, Anderson Cooper from CNN texted me. And all he said was very nice. He said, I'm sorry to hear about your friend. And I texted him right back, new phone, who this? He said, it's Anderson Cooper. I said, Anderson. I go, look, I need to find her family. And he texted me right back with all the phone numbers and all this information. I say this to say, if you ever want to know about anything gay, call Anderson Cooper from CNN. This nigga is faster than Google. What I did is I got in touch with the family and I started a trust fund for her daughter because I know that's all she ever really cared about. And I don't know what the trans community did for her, but I don't care because I feel like she wasn't their tribe. She was mine. She was a comedian in her soul. Her daughter is very young, but I hope to be alive when she turns 21 because I'm going to give her this money myself. And by then, I'll be ready to have the conversation that I'm not ready to have today. But I'll tell that little girl, young lady, I knew your father. And he was a wonderful woman. Empathy is not gay. Empathy is not black. Empathy is bisexual. It must go both ways. It must go both ways.
Oh, she is.
And she probably, it seems like she wants you to be in her life, a positive influence.
Oh, definitely. She told me that.
But, you know, she probably, you know, she wrote it off with you're coming on a bounce back thing. But I think she more knows she's not the woman for you.
Yeah.
But she wants to be your friend. She's trying to walk that line.
Oh, yeah.
Where she doesn't want to be your lover, which is what you wanted.
Right.
But she wants to get to where she thinks you and she would be in a better, more honest and effective and a successful space.
Yeah.
Which is as friends. So that's good. I mean, it sounds like she really cares.
Oh, she does. She does.
So you've got yourself someone in your life that cares.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And having female energy, I mean, we talked about this a long time ago, but having that live female energy in your life is a very good thing.
Oh, definitely.
Because it makes you... It brings out our warm, our tender, our emotional sides to protect and nurture and care for, and also to be vulnerable. You know, women not only nurture, but they allow themselves to be nurtured. And sometimes men resist being nurtured.
Yeah.
It's almost harder to let someone take care of you than to take care of someone else.
Yeah.
So when you have women in your life, they remind you that it's fun to take care of and it's fun to be taken care of. And there's no shame, there's no harm in any of it. You know, it's actually wonderful.
It is.
So, one more woman in your life and a good woman. If you select your women well, then, you know, it's good. It's like you win, you know.
Crank this just a tad.
Yeah.
All this stuff. I don't know what the fuck he's saying, but I love it.
Well, he wants to show me the lyrics, and they're all love songs, right?
Oh, they're all love songs. That's why I get drunk out of Egypt. He's persona non grata of Egypt.
So Rick, man, next Saturday is fucking D-Day, man.
I know it.
Next Saturday is going to be fucking almost out of control.
It's going to be completely out of control.
You know, it's like a lot of fucking forces are gathering, man.
Yeah.
I'm like simultaneously fucking ecstatic and fucking, like, I just want everybody to have a good time, you know? You know, just a little bit, you know, I mean, I think it's good to be a little bit like this.
Yeah.
Because I want everybody to have a good time. And it's like a lot of fucking forces are descending. All these different people, you know, and it's like you've met all of them here and there, one-on-one, two, three people at a time. This is going to be like 8 or 9 major forces.
It's going to be very intense.
Oh, man. I'm telling you, man, fucking Jim and you and Joe and fucking Neil and fucking Barbara.
Yeah.
You know, Jerry and me and a lot of
Mark.
Yeah, Mark, exactly. So it's, and everybody's fucking worked up. Everybody's fucking doing shit. Barbara fucking left her job and she's like going for new shit. She wants to move up here. Jerry just got a new job. You just moved back and got a job. And fucking Neo just met a guy, so she's all fucking worked up. You know. Everybody's kind of a lot.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know of anybody in this number to pick this particular group of people. Nobody's, lost. Nobody's, without a clue. Everybody has some fucking thing that's going on. Some hopeful, positive thing. So it's going to be, This is going to be your breakout night, Rick. I mean, we've been, together a few times. But this will be the night when you've got enough people there who will listen to you. And you must leave.
I will.
I'll do the fucking poetry shit. I'll make sure everybody gets to read and everybody gets to play.
We'll take their turn.
You know, we'll do that. We always do that because everybody feels better after that. Everybody brings a little something. You got to make sure that everybody gets their turn. It's the right conduct, you know. But once we've done that, you know, it'll be like later part of the evening.
Yeah.
We won't want to stay at Curious Liquids Cafe all night. Just there for 3 or 4 hours, you know, will be enough. There's no booze there. You can't smoke there. You can only go out so far. You know, it'll be a good place to start.
Yeah.
At that point, you know, if Joe comes and if Joe's place is cool for moving the party, we'll move it.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You know. Because he's got a big place, much bigger than this, and we can be noisy. He said he had a big party the other night, and the neighbor's party, so there's no trouble, you know?
Well, I know that Neil is going to dance with me all night.
Right, exactly. Exactly. You know that ahead of time. You've already broken.
That was
broken.
So wonderful.
Yeah, I know.
She's cool.
Yeah. Yeah, she's a wonderful person. I'm glad you got to meet her.
I am glad too.
And I'm glad you got to meet you.
I think that, you know, as we were driving, to be honest, my interpretation of the evening, I think she was a little bit, who's this guy in the backseat, swirling the beer, you know, But then we got there tonight, we danced, man. We fucking did.
Yeah, she like, her thing these days is that she holds back until the moment's right, and then she does not hesitate for a moment.
No.
You think you've got her pegged, but then the moment's right, and she fucking is there.
Yeah, yeah.
She needs no fucking second fucking invitation. You know? None at all. She didn't want to dance at the other place because she wasn't into it, you know?
Right, right. I appreciate that.
She knows when she wants to dance like you, you know? She knows when the moment is right. When the moment's right, she's fucking, like, all over the place.
Yeah, yeah.
So she's discriminating. Because when she throws herself into it, she's going to be completely into it without any fucking hesitation. Wiley, you let me know when you want me to lay out the futon.
Okay.
I never actually put it away. I didn't know you were coming back so soon. But I've been so busy, I haven't had... Like, I haven't had much of a chance to do anything but, like, my thing. Thesis thing. I would be so fucking glad when that thing's done, man. It's a fucking, like... It's far more personal than I thought it was going to be. I should have figured it'd be fucking personal. How could it not be personal?
Right, right.
But... I thought, like, I could just, like, do it, you know, sort of state the facts and little flourishes and fucking sign it. And it's like I'm sitting there fucking realizing I've got to write about you. How do I describe to the unknown reader you? You know, there's your poetry, then you went to Seattle, and it's like there's this whole Seattle thing going on, and, you know, you do the Seattle book. And then I go out there, and I haven't even written about that one, but I go out to Seattle, I take the photos, and we do the fucking yellow book and shit. It's like, all this shit is like a mixture of, it's a mixture of art and friendship with so many different people that it's impossible to describe it without getting personal. I've gotten personal a lot. I mean, I talked about tripping. I didn't name Hartley's name because I knew he wouldn't like that.
Yeah.
But I just said I had an opportunity.
Oh, where's my bag?
Where are we doing the Hartley?
Where are we doing the Hartley lines?
But I had to describe that experience because Hartley's, you know, that was an important experience among many, and I had to describe it in order to describe other things. And I found that the deeper I get into it, and the closer I get to now, the more anecdotes and personal remembrances I recall. And, you know, it's not completely manifesto, because I haven't, like, let myself loose like that, but it definitely discusses a lot of personal things. If you need a light, there's a light behind you. It's been fairly straightforward. I haven't really, I've been so busy trying to get everything down that I haven't really embellished it a lot with, you know, flowery language or anything like that. I just pretty much told the story. The story itself is so fucking, like, strange and peculiar that it almost doesn't need embellishment. It's like I know my professor that I'm giving it to has never lived anything of a life like mine. Or like yours. You know, he's a great guy. He's fucking a brother. But, you know, he's like Chris. He's like on the other side. He's
right, right.
Sedate, polished, and, you know, a deep thinking person, but not living the kind of lives you and I live.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I was like reflecting upon my life the other night, for better or worse, really. And like, my life is like so strange.
Yeah.
So strange by, you know, certain standards.
Oh, yeah.
But thank you, Ray, for pushing me to get a book together. That they have this book together. And it's like such a calling card, you know. It's like, you don't even know me. I don't even know if you want to know me. But look, here's some stuff I bring. Take this book. Do with it what you will, you know. It will give you an insight into my mind, you know. Well, let me put it to you this way, Rick. I appreciate your thanks, but I have to tell you that I didn't give you the desire to have a book. Yeah, I merely helped you to realize a desire you had.
Yeah, I did have a desire.
Because there are other people I know who I would love to put a book together with, but they don't really have the motivation to do the work.
Right.
And in order to put together something like yours, I mean, we fucking worked in that mother for months.
Yeah.
Months.
Yeah.
To make it look like, I mean, now it's done, we can fucking celebrate.
Right.
But we were at that motherfucker for months.
Yeah.
And in order to do that, it's like the person who's working, the editor, has to have an enthusiastic writer.
Right.
You know, if you don't have someone who really cares about it, then it never fucking goes anywhere. So, you know, your desire to publish a book, coupled with my desire to help you, it was like a collaboration.
Yeah.
And so I have as much to thank you for, like, wanting to do it and being willing to put up with the fucking work to do it right.
Yeah.
We could have done it half-assed.
No.
You know the zines and shit.
Right.
You know, the fucking photocopies and the fucking punk guys. And it's like, that's fine, but you can't give that as you did, like, Carol Horn, owner of Harvard Bookstore, and say, this is my book and I'm proud of it and you'll like it. Because it's not, like, she can't translate the look. It's like, the contents are fucking radical, but they're not presented in a kind of way.
Yeah.
They're presented classically.
Exactly.
Classically, beautifully, confidently.
Right.
But the thoughts themselves are completely fucking...
Yeah.
But you get the person like Carol Horn or whoever to look at it because it's got a beautiful cover with a nice paper.
Yeah.
And it's fucking nicely laid out.
She said that too. I showed her the book. She said, this is such a beautiful cover.
Yeah. So that's the thing. I mean, that's what I was like learning with writing about the Cenacle. That as it's gotten nicer looking, the thoughts have gotten crazier. But you see, because it gets looking nicer, and the thoughts get crazier, it's still fucking, like, cool. You know, it's like when the Beatles were way the fuck out there, they did that wonderful Sgt. Pepper cover.
Right.
Which is so elegant. And then they had this album full of fucking heavy-duty Eastern drug music.
Right.
You know? But it's a beautiful package, so people give it that shot. They're willing to have an open mind.
Yeah.
So I thank you for being willing to put in the fucking work to produce a book like that.
Yeah.
That is something I'm proud of that I can show people and say, you know, I worked on this.
Yeah.
I showed that to, like, people I worked with in Cambridge, the editorial people. I gave them a copy of that. I said, this is something I published.
Yeah.
You know, this, and then they're like, whoa, check this dude out. Look at this. So we have it's mutual.
Yeah.
And always remember that.
All right.
That, you know, we've benefited each other by having a good, solid, successful working relationship.
Yeah.
So what did Harley say?
All right.
Did you find Harley words?
So Harley has this fantasy about a person going into, like, a all-night Stop and Shop with a wheelbarrow. And...
Yeah, because it's fantasies. It's so many food store fantasies, but it's ridiculous. Go on.
Yeah, but it's a wheelbarrow
with
a computer mounted on the wheelbarrow. And the person's going down the aisle and pulls, a jar of ragu.
Yeah.
And, has to check on the internet. What are the nutritional values of this thing?
Yeah.
What are the political implications of buying this particular brand of sauce? He went into this whole thing. It was beautiful. And his line was, this woman who was wielding this wheelbarrow with the computer-mounted scanner.
Right.
That would, clog up the aisles. He told me it would clog up the aisles. It was, giving people, it was great. He's like, it could be somebody from the suburbs coming here from Lincoln just trying to do some spot shopping. It could be somebody like myself who's been on the road for months and just wants to get some fucking good, like, week break.
Yeah. Yeah.
But this person has a wheelbarrow with the computer. They're checking it all out. And Hartley says, this is what the person says. Nobody's doing this. And it needs to be done. Hartley. All right, so in lots of this, I can't read up. But this is the other point. I can really just do. So I told Hartley about the time out. And this is my trip. Like I told you, I took everything from my trip.
Yeah.
And just like jacked it a notch further.
Right.
So when I was in Milwaukee, and I told you this, I had the bus driver who was like really witty, he was falling asleep.
Yeah.
But Hartley had this better scenario. He said, okay, wait. I understand what you're saying, but let's take it a bit further. And you get off the bus, and you bring all these people off the bus with you, and then the bus driver, who's sleeping, wakes up and looks in his rearview mirror, and there's nobody there.
That's good.
But then he said to me, and I told him, I said, you know, the first part of my trip from Seattle to Detroit, I chose not to drink. And he said, okay, that's interesting. And he said, and I told him, I drunk after that. You know? But here's the line he had for me. Like, I've chosen not to drink, but I think this bus driver's kind of fucked up. So he says, all right, let's make believe. And I told him I was smoking a little bit. He says, let's make believe that, and not make believe, but you're smoking a little bit of pot. Go into this bar, and I told you about this bar in North Dakota.
Oh, with the bowling alley.
With the bowling alley. This is, you know, everything is getting kind of twisted and strange here.
Yeah.
Like, you're right, it was completely twisted and strange. Okay, you bust out of the bus in somewhere in North Dakota, and you say, anybody who doesn't want to die, follow me. And Holly had this whole thing. That'd be perfect, because of course you're paranoid, but think of like terrorists, you know, there's a bomb on the bus.
Yeah.
So like, you're a fucking out of your mind, but if you like are completely strong and say that, anybody who doesn't want to die, follow me, then you will have people follow you.
Yeah.
Regardless of your state of mind.
Right, right. Right, yes. That's a good point.
Yeah.
And then what would you do with them?
That's when you lead them into the grocery. And then Hartley had it all broken up. He said, okay, so you leave the bus, and there are like, you know, 30 people. And some of them just like want to call home. But some of them are thinking like, we have to get food. And that's when Hartley led this whole beautiful story into the supermarket with the wheelbarrow, with the computer.
With the computer, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ah. Very
tricky.
It
was beautiful. It was beautiful.
Oh, yeah. Oh my God.
Oh, then here's the big thing. Okay, I have this down here. I'm glad I took notes.
Oh, it's always good to take notes of Hartley.
So here's the big thing about Hartley. He's dropped off entropy. His big thing is the Weather Channel.
The Weather Channel?
Yes.
He's calling weather patterns now.
Yes.
Burke loves the Weather Channel.
He said, you know, you can look around the world and see, you know, friction in Kosovo that's been, you know, discovered, and things in East Timor. Says the Weather Channel is the only solid thing you can trust. He says if more people look at the Weather Channel, it would be like a better year.
That's great. Fucking Hartley and Burke are fucking avid viewers of the fucking Weather Channel.
That was it. I mean,
the non-television watching Hartley has finally found his favorite channel. He's finally found a channel that he can watch. Fucking Weather Channel. When I used to live in Boston, Rick, in Boston, the cable company, they have so many channels. They have the Weather Channel, you know, always tells you the weather and shit. And then there's the channel that just shows you the radar. It's just like the fucking radar for fucking New England. It just shows you when storms are coming and shit, and there's like the line that goes around.
Right.
Jim would fucking be at my house watching the fucking radar channel for hours.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, he's the same way. Fascinated by the fucking radar channel. Oh, yeah, that's right. Barbara sent you the fucking weather radio.
Yeah, I'm a weather person, too.
Yeah.
And I completely hooked up when Hartley said that. I said, you're right, you know.
That's intriguing. You and Hartley and Burke, I mean, just three completely, you know, insane people.
Yeah.
Very intrigued by the weather. And you and Burke are both mathematicians. Does Hartley have any math?
Not, you know, specifically, but...
Yeah.
But that was the big thing about Harley. It's just like, you know, Rick, the Weather Channel, that's it. That's it.
Fucking guys hold up in fucking Melrose, watching the fucking Weather Channel all day long.
He is. When I took him out, like, we went out for a walk. So Miriam comes in, right? Oh, don't you guys want to go for a walk? And she's doing her, like, stupid female thing.
Yeah.
And I actually wanted to go for a walk.
Yeah.
And but apparently, Hartley had not left his apartment for 3 weeks. But she said to me, oh, Dave, you know, you haven't left in 3 weeks. Why don't you take a walk with Rick, you know?
He fought it.
Huh?
He fought it. This is the tape. We'll play it as long as it's interesting. This is a tape a kid gave me out at Burning Man. This kid that's into, like, fucking rave music, and he lives in New York. He gave me this tape when we were out in Nevada at Burning Man. And it's a really good tape. I really like it. It's like good sort of techno music, but it's really interesting. It's tuneful and odd. So it was a good visit with Hartley.
It was a very good visit with Hartley.
But
I pushed him somewhere further.
Yeah, the
he didn't want to be pushed. He resisted.
Really?
Oh,
well,
yeah.
I mean, he's fucking, like, holed up in his fucking house watching the Weather Channel.
Yeah.
But you came in like a force not to be resisted.
Oh, of course. Yeah. I had him drink half a bottle of red wine and smoke pot, which he had not done in months.
I love that. Fucking Miriam comes home, fucking drunk and stoned, and you're sitting there, and he's telling about the fucking computerized fucking shovel.
He went up to this whole thing about it, and it's like, Miriam's like, what do you mean, Dave? You know, he's like, well,
that look, I know the look.
Yeah.
I used to visit him a lot more, but I couldn't stand the fucking look. You saw the look. I have no doubt you saw the fucking look.
Yeah.
Not Dave is a fucking crack madman. Let's save him and keep him. The universe needs him. But like, oh God, he's fucking sitting at home watching the fucking Weather Channel, and Rick comes over and gets him stoned, and now what do I have to deal with?
Right.
And he's not marrying me and having children and, you know, raising them in the fucking faith and shit, you know. I don't know how long that fucking thing can go on.
I don't think it's going much longer.
But it's gone on for a while, that's the only thing.
Yeah.
It'll go on as long as she's willing to deal with it.
Yeah.
Because Harley's not going to throw her out. Because she lives there, you know. She doesn't have anywhere else to go.
Right.
And he's, you know, he's living off of her fucking paycheck.
And I must say, I think I told you this. I mean, I was a little bit disappointed in Harley. Because it's like, I felt that, I mean, I feel that Harley's taking a, convenient middle ground.
Yeah.
Whereby, okay, here's a woman he can fuck. And, you know, I'm sure he'll
stay home.
What is going on? He can stay home. And he's bringing home the bacon. Blah, blah, blah. It's convenient. It's nice. It works. But it's not pure.
Of course it's not pure. I don't visit him nearly as much as I used to. I live one town over from the guy.
Yeah.
And I haven't visited him in months. I mean, I've talked to him on the phone a few times, and he's always like, Ray, you got to come over soon. I'm like, yeah, I will, but I don't want to deal with her, and I don't want to deal with Dad.
Yeah.
Honestly. I don't dislike her. But...
I don't either.
But the fact of the matter is as you saw...
Right. It's just not right.
As you saw, you know, she comes home, and... You know, thank God you were there, but, like, when she comes home and I would be there, I would, like, immediately begin to, like, retract. It's like, okay, you know, I know Hartley's going to tell her the story of whatever we've been doing, because, of course, he will. He's enthused. He's worked up. He's, like, not watching the fucking Weather Channel. He's with his friend, you know? But I know she's going to make the face, and I've learned the fucking drill. I spent a good 15, 20 minutes just talking to her, fucking finding out her fucking shit. It's always the same shit, you know, I don't like the job, but blah, 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 oh, Dave this, blah, blah, blah. It's never anything harmful. It's just so fucking mundane and conventional and boring.
Yeah.
But I think Hartley's thing is, for and, you know, take it or leave it, and I think that if you call him on it, then call him on it, but, you know, he worked that fucking job until his fucking wrists were fucking, like, busted.
Yeah.
And then he quit. And meanwhile, he's in this relationship that, you know, he knows is not Mia. You know, it's not fucking love forever or whatever. But This is the girl who's willing to fucking front him the money to live. Yeah. And I don't know, has he got his fucking workers' comp, or is that still fucking, like, out there in the air?
Yeah, he does have it.
It's finally been worked?
Yeah.
You know, so he's, like, got his check every month or whatever?
Yeah.
Well, then, you know, then he doesn't have a reason to fucking, like, he can, you know. I just think that, you know, she's probably very dependent, you know. Dude, just go over when she's not there. I'm sorry, I'm going on.
No, yeah, you're right.
Bottom line, just visit when she's not there.
Yeah, exactly.
And when she comes home, if you feel the vibe is fucking dragging you down, it's like, oh, you know, gotta get up for work tomorrow, which will be true. You know, I'll see you later, Dave. And he knows the score. Dave, as you know, and I know, and we've said it before, is one of the most astutely sensitive men in the entire fucking world.
Yeah, he knows the score completely.
But if you have to go shortly after she comes, I mean, he's going to know that, you know. And you don't have to say anything. You don't have to come down on
it. No.
But, you know, that's just...
I guess, I mean, to be honest with
you, I don't know what else to say.
No, I mean, I'll tell you one more thing. Tell me what you think about this. We've talked, you and I, about being involved with a woman who is, you know, a muse.
Yeah.
And I guess sometimes I squirm because I know that Hartley's involved with this woman who's not a muse, who's, like, convenient.
Yeah.
Who's, you know, giving him a hole, he can fuck.
And then it comes.
And
some warmth, some human warmth.
Oh yeah, definitely. That's it. I'm not denying that.
Yeah.
But I think that you and I have a greater agenda in terms of what we want to be around in terms of a woman.
Well, there's a price.
There is a price. I mean,
even a good relationship, there's a price.
The price is loneliness.
No. I mean, there's the price to not being with someone is loneliness. And the price to being with someone is that you are now co-opted your time and some of your energy into.
Right.
You know, if it's a great relationship, then you are dying to see the person the next time. But, you know, you still have to spend nights you would spend doing your own shit, doing that.
Right.
You suddenly get into situations where you would go out, you know, by yourself, you're autonomous, and, like, now you're with the girl, do you bring her out to every fucking bar? Every time you go to a bar with a buddy, do you have to bring her, or is she cool?
Right.
You know, there's all sorts of, like, all of a sudden this thing rears its head in every decision you make.
Exactly.
I mean, Hartley can stand and watch the Weather Channel all fucking day. Is that good for him, ultimately? Probably not.
No, I don't think so.
Is it good for him to fucking blow off a day at work and sit home and watch the Weather Channel? Yes.
Yeah.
Is it good for him to work in a job where his wrists are fucked up? No. What kind of job should he be working at? He should be a fucking computer guru guy. But does he have the fucking, like, X's and O's to actually assemble himself to get a job in the computer industry? No. It's a problem. He can fucking build them, he can tear them apart, he's always like, yeah, I built Miriam a computer, and it's like, well, I don't know how to fucking do that, I don't know how they fucking work.
Right,
you can do that, you did it for free, out of fucking junk, you go into the dumpster, a couple of fucking pieces of chassis, and it's his fucking computer.
Yeah.
But he can't, you know, is he a great musician? Yes. Can he translate that into making records or playing live in stage? No. So he builds computers, he watches the Weather Channel, he plays music, and he fucking hides. It's complicated, you know?
It's very complicated.
But then you come along, you come back, he now knows you're here, and that disrupts this sort of, like, facade of fucking everything's fine, as much as he could possibly believe that. And that's good. So you just play your role, and I'm sure that over the time it will have a good effect.
Yeah.
But I understand.
Well, I guess
and I can see that night very
what bums me out,
you.
I guess, to be honest with you, is I like Hartley. I love Hartley because he's such a fucking purist.
Because
of what we're talking about.
Yeah.
But I mean, this whole situation with Miriam, I mean, I just know that it's so pragmatic to be with Miriam. And I know he doesn't love her.
No.
And I guess, you know, like yourself, I think, I am, like, so fucking hardcore romance. It's like, if you're a fucking woman, then that woman has to be everything, you know?
Yeah,
and I know that woman's not everything.
No.
And so I think that, and I think Hartley knows that about me. And,
It goose-ism, I bet.
It does goose-ism. Yeah. It does goose-ism.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that, I mean,
what am I trying to say?
You make compromises in your life, but what sort of compromises do you want to make,
Good question. What are you willing to give up?
Yes.
What are you willing to forego to achieve what you really think you want?
Exactly.
It's hard.
It is very hard. It is very hard.
I mean, Hartley, like, he's willing to forego a certain amount of time and energy that he'd be putting into productive, scheming and being a guru and being an artist. He gains that home. The payment, the rent, or whatever, fucking mortgage, a woman in bed with him every night, he doesn't have to work.
Right.
Exactly. When I look at myself, my sacrifice doesn't have to do with women, it has to do with money. I borrowed a lot of money to go to school to get up to Boston. And then I borrowed a lot of money to go to Emerson to try and fucking figure it all out. And I'll be fucking in debt for the rest of my life. I get letters, I get fucking phone calls, and, my only defense is I don't have a fucking job. So, but it's like, it's always a present thing. It's an equivalent to what Hartley deals with. It's like a constant fucking nagging hassle.
Yeah.
And a fear that one day, they'll bring back fucking debtors for they'll have me fucking lined up. I'll be the first in fucking line. They'll have me a fucking arm and leg chains and a fucking ball in my mouth. I'll be the fucking man in the iron mask. But that's my fucking cross to bear.
Yeah.
Hartley's, and you've told me this about Hartley. You told me that when he gets with a woman, that he gets a little soft.
Oh, he does.
He gets complacent.
Yeah.
He gets
comfortable.
So I think that's his cross to bear.
Oh, it is completely.
And you have often yourself. I mean, you don't have the debt I do, but on the other hand, you have often because you have this need to keep moving. You have often sacrificed the comforts of a situation you've achieved with a home and a job,
right?
To up. Go, because your blood's starting to get stale.
Yeah.
And so you have had a lot of situations where another person would have settled in for the long run, and you settle in for the short term until it gets old, and then you move on, even if it means uprooting everything, leaving shit behind, family, friends. If you're leaving here, on the other end, Seattle, you left behind, good friends there, and you had a job at one point, you had fucking beautiful home, cheap rent, ferry boats, but you're a restless man who's trying to keep ahead of his own fucking, devils of, not doing it anymore, not fucking going at all speeds. All pistons, You're trying not to settle. To sediment, that's what I'm looking for. You don't want to be sedimentary.
And
the price for not being a sedimentary man is that you often have to give up a life that it takes you several years to fucking, assemble.
Right.
And then you fucking go.
Well, thank you for saying that, right.
Because that's... I'm trying to figure out what are each of our things.
No, thank you.
The things
that
we have to deal with.
Can I say something to you honestly?
Yeah.
I guess, I'm not roomy, right? So I still have an ego involved. And I think sometimes I get a little bit bummed out because... Other than you understand where I'm coming from. A lot of people don't understand... My passage, they don't understand how difficult it is for me to, yeah, I got this place in Burlington, and I have some friends, and things could work out here. But there's an inner calling that tells me I have to go away and I have to come back here. Or there's been an inner calling, you know, 10 years ago, that said, you had to go to New Orleans. People don't understand that. People just do not understand that.
It's a calling.
It is a calling.
It's a calling. That's a good word for it.
Yeah.
I mean, I see it completely. I didn't understand it until you told me you were coming back to Boston. And it's like, I was so into the you moving to Seattle thing that I'd forgotten that your history is not of moving somewhere and staying, but of moving somewhere and staying until it's time to go.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then when it's time to go, you go.
Right, right.
And that's just been, that'll probably be always part of your history.
I think so. And I guess what I'm trying to say to you is that people think it's so fucking easy from an outsider's perspective. They think, not easy, but they think that, oh God, isn't Rick such a free spirit? You know, he goes here, he goes there. And yes, I do go here and I go there. But I guess this is what makes my life a dream. And that people don't understand. I think you maybe understand how much spiritual demolishing and building up takes me to do this. And a lot of people think, oh, they, yeah, well, that's, tell me your bus stories. Yes, I was on the bus. I'm anxious to do that. Sure, I have good bus stories.
There's a cost of freedom.
There's a complete cost of freedom. That's the point.
You've been doing this for a lot of years. Ever since you fucking left fucking BU.
That's the point,
which must have been back in like 74 or 75.
I'm trying to make. Thank you, Ray.
25 fucking years.
Thank you, Ray. Thank you very much.
Of being on the fucking road.
Yeah. And people don't understand how fragile my soul is.
Yeah.
I have a big soul.
Yeah.
And I try to, you know, incorporate my soul into my poems and talk about things. But, you know, I mean, I just sometimes get so fucking weary.
Yeah.
Because people don't understand. Like, we didn't even see John last night. It's like, oh, you're back in Boston now. And that was it, you know. It's like, people don't ask me, like, what does it mean for you to be back in Boston? What does it mean for you to return to a place that you loved and then went away and then came back?
Yeah, I asked you that. I was, like, trying to figure out how the fuck it's changed, because I know that I've been here all along, so it's been...
Yeah, and I thank you.
I've been all along here. You would, like, 3 years missing except for one visit. You would have that perspective.
Yeah, yeah.
And you said it was a lot in your head.
It's complete. I am so... I can't go into words, but it's like, I go back to the dream. And this woman tonight, I appreciate the fact that she said, like, Rumi was, like, always in a dream. And the older I get, I'm just like, I am the most physical and be here now person probably you ever want to be around. But there's another side of me that is like, it's so vaporous. It's such a fucking dream. You know? And I guess this is my ego that I have to, from Rumi, thank you, Rumi. I mean, Rumi, other great teachers, it's like, I have to drop that off, you know, but sometimes it stings. It really stings because, you know, people see me back here and it's like, oh, Rick's back. Fine, Rick's back. And that's it, you know, they're content with Rick's back. They don't ask me, what does it mean for you to be around, to be back, you know? And they don't understand. They don't understand my life. I mean, I'm sorry, I don't mean to be...
It's true. I understand.
Nobody understands your life, too.
I understand. I know what you're saying.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know.
It's a slap in the face sometimes when, like, you're back in the swing of things. Okay, I'm here, and there's, like, so much shit that I've been through in the last couple of years.
I know.
That people, you know, God bless them, but I don't know. They don't say, what did it mean to you to be with the woman you loved for 18 years and all of a sudden went up? You know, what did it mean? All these things that are like so heavy in my soul that people don't ask. ask me about.
You know, it's funny you say that, because when I was reading your letters from when you first went out there, I realized that there were a lot of times when, in our phone calls, because they were long distance, and in your letters, because you had a hard time getting it down on paper, there were a lot of times when, you know, you wanted to say more and couldn't at the time.
Yeah.
And I realized that even though I kept in touch with you along the way, you know, there's a lot about your time out there that I can't even pretend to understand.
No.
I mean, literally or figuratively, like in terms of facts as well as in terms of feelings. And, you know, I'm hoping over the course of time, as, you know, you get settled in here and you can reflect on that more as a separate period, that you talk about it. Because there were a lot of times that we were just like, oh, if we could only be in the same place and in a tavern and across the counter from each other. But it's like that accumulated, you know. It's like there was a lot of times of that where you wanted to say something and you didn't. Because, you know, we've been on for an hour talking about shit, and now we get into the deep shit, but, you know, we've been on an hour. Or, you know, you write a letter, but, you know, whatever. You know, it's like you only want to go so far or whatever. And so there were a lot of stuff that, you know, you didn't get into that, you know, interests me.
Yeah.
At your, you know, at whatever you want to say about it.
Yeah, yeah.
That, I mean,
thanks, Ryan.
Your early letters, really, I was reading them in the context of you being back and of the years that had intervened since them, as opposed to when I read them, you know, at the time, you know. And I was thinking, you know, you're living at the Panama, you're working the temp jobs, you know, and I know that you eventually moved to Bremerton, and eventually you got the bookstore job, and you're talking about Jane, and I'm seeing the seeds of the fucking disaster with Jane at your arrival months. Because you're talking over and over and over, letter after letter after letter. All you say is, I hope Jane gets work soon, sooner than later, because it would make everything a lot easier. And now I'm reading it in retrospect and realizing that she was never going to get fucking work.
Yeah.
You know, she got a few temp jobs here and there, but ultimately, you're fucking on pins and needles trying to settle your shit, but at that time, you kept thinking that, okay, she's going to get a job, and then we're going to, like, fucking, like, move to, you were talking about Idaho at one point,
right.
You know, and fucking, you were thinking, like, you might move to San Francisco, and it's like, and the letters leave off with you still have no idea what's coming. No fucking clue what's coming. And, you know, so your expectations when you went out there with her, emotionally, relationship-wise, and in terms of circumstance, you were holding off getting a full-time job for a while.
Oh, yeah,
because
definitely.
You didn't even know if you were going to stay in Seattle.
Oh, yeah, of course.
You were, like, gearing yourself up. We may move to Idaho, we move to San Francisco.
Right.
So, you know, I kind of, like, got a little, it was a kind of a smack of realization that as much as I thought I knew about your time up there, it reminded me I really don't. I know as much as you told me, I may know more than other people, but in the scheme of things, in terms of truth, I don't really know the story.
Yeah.
I just want to tell you that I acknowledge and I admit I don't know the story.
Okay.
And whenever you want to fucking rant about the story, you know, hit the fucking button and we'll go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it was telling.
Yeah.
It was reminding, you know, it was good. It brought it back, you know. How was those first few months, and how it turned out?
Right.
You know, I mean, it's really weird. You have a arrival date, a departure date. It was June 14th, 97, and you came back here October like 11th or something, or 13th. No. It was. Sorry, it was October 7th. You came back. So it's like I now have the two dates of when you went out there and when you came back. But man, you went through a lot of shit out there. All I'm saying is I'm just endorsing your fucking view that fucking passage of almost 2.5 years was a fucking amazing fucking period. And you grew so much as a person, and you had so many good experiences, and met so many people, and gave out so much love. But I think that the suffering factor in there, in and amongst the love and the joy and the hard work, was fucking pretty intense.
It was very intense.
You know,
yeah.
Paid a fucking price.
Yeah, well, definitely.
You I'm glad you're here for nothing, else, that for however long it lasts. One of the things you lacked out there that never quite, you weren't able to turn around, was you just didn't have enough people.
Yeah.
You had Mark, and you had the married guy, Zach.
Right.
And it seemed like there were other people that were sort of in the hemispheres.
Right.
See once in a while, but you just didn't have a lot of people backing you up.
No, I didn't.
And it shot you through some fucking rapids.
Oh, completely.
In a good way.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, I mean, obviously you bear the bruises.
Samuel X with Commander Q.
X
with Commander Q. Train.
And spirit and all radio, your broadcast, broadcast the world over on radio.com. Tell me, and the web, 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 and the web